Welcome to Research Bites, the podcast about research students and their journeys in academia. My name is Imtiaz, and today we've got the full gang together. Felix is back, and Lachlan. Today we are chatting to John Kerr. He's a PhD candidate in the Locomotion Research Group in the School of Health Sciences, Faculty of Medicine and Health at UNSW, and he's researching knee loads and how we walk. Hi, John, and welcome.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Oh, yeah. Back. Feeling better than ever.
Act like you never left. Yeah.
So, thanks for joining us. What we'd like to get to know first is your journey to where you are now. So what did you do in undergrad and how did you end up in this PhD project?
My journey to Australia. I guess it's a bit of a convoluted story in a certain sense. So I started off, in the US when I was going into college, university, I wanted to be a doctor. I was like, okay, want to be a doctor, want to study medicine, want to do this. My aunt had done it. My grandfather had done it. That's what I thought I wanted to do. About a week into my studies, I was like, nope, never mind. Don't think so.
Why was that?
I think just I saw all the like different hoops and hurdles you had to jump through. And then once you did that in university, in the US, you just have to go to med school after that as well. It's not like, I guess it's combined here in Australia.
Yeah.
But in the US, it's like two separate kind of educational paths. You do your base undergraduate in whatever you decide, and then you go to med school.
Oh.
And so it's like, you're not really a doctor until you're 30 something, maybe. And then you have mountains of debt after that.
I do kind of like vibe with that. I feel like in Australia, it probably is a bit too quick. You know, like how can you be like 23 or 24 and be like, oh, I'm a medical like professional doctor. And you're like, yeah, okay. Like, I mean, all power to you. Like, congratulations. But like, I don't know.
I'm about to go under and it's like a bunch of honest students around me. Yeah. Like,
oh yeah, my nightmare.
This is why you didn't do it.
Yeah. So I audibled from med to engineering. I was like, okay, if I'm not going to do medicine, let me at least do something kind of related to the field in some form or fashion. And I was good at math and science as a kid in school, primary school. So I was like, all right, biomedical engineering makes most sense. And then while I was there, I got into this lab that focused on prosthetics. And it's actually where I met my current advisor for my PhD now, Dr. Kirsty McDonald. I worked at the Vanderbilt Create Lab. Shout out to them. Taught me a lot.
Whereabouts is this?
Is in Nashville, Tennessee. Nashville. At Vanderbilt. Yeah. Great city. Great lab. Great people. Super country music.
Right?
I took a class on the history of country music.
Oh, did you?
I fell asleep a lot in that class. Hopefully the professor isn't listening.
A couple of one-legged cowboys out there.
Yeah. They put us in an auditorium and then played country music. How'd they expect us not to fall asleep, to be fair? I don't know. It was 9 a.m. So I worked in a prosthetics research lab there. And then I kind of was on the fence about research, whether I wanted to stick with it, whether I wanted to just kind of start my career, go into industry in some form or fashion. And so I did a master's, and then I was like, you know what? I kind of missed the research because I did my master's during COVID, so I wasn't doing anything. It was just coursework. And I was like, you know, I kind of miss working in a research lab. And so I started kind of putting out feelers for PhDs, was going to stay in the US. And then Kirsty, who I was kind of like chatting to on and off, getting advice from, was like, hey, we actually have this opportunity here in Australia if you're interested. And I was like, I'd always thought about living abroad. I never really thought it would actually happen. I never thought about Australia because I'm so far from the US. I think so many Americans think about Australia and they're like, wait, no, that's too far. It's never going to happen. It's just because we're not used to that long flight. Time zone difference, everything. So I never thought it would happen. And then the more I talked to her, the more it made sense. And then one thing led to another, application submitted, accepted, and here I am. And you know, it's been pretty good so far. So,
and so you're with Kirsty now doing your PhD. What level are you at now?
So this is my second year. Yeah. Year and a half in, pretty much midway. Oh, wow. I'm not the newbie anymore. Interesting. Yeah. And so I'm still kind of focusing on prosthetics a bit, but more shifted towards the lens of like knee osteoarthritis, knee loading, and walking, activities of daily living. So also looking at able body populations who don't have prostheses, who are just like kind of in the early stages of osteoarthritis development.
So, and is it also osteoarthritis in prosthesis users, or is that a different part of the project?
So it's kind of focused in a sense on the lens of osteoarthritis, because people with below knee prostheses tend to generate intact limbs. So on their other side, osteoarthritis in that knee, I think at a rate like 17 times that like the able-bodied population. And there are a bunch of different theories as to why. And so I'm kind of looking more into the mechanistic side and kind of the general loading we experience during walking, because especially early on when they're still kind of recovering, rehabilitating from the surgery or whatever led them to getting the prosthesis, they tend to kind of like offload that limb. It could be like socket discomfort, it could be lack of a trust in their device. There's a bunch of different factors. So I'm kind of trying to see how physically they walk in terms of the joint kinematics, kinetics, and then also do some funky musculoskeletal modeling, see what's going on in the joints as well.
Very cool.
Can you touch on a bit more about like what osteoarthritis actually is?
Yeah, so it's like the degeneration of the joint space cartilage. In the knee, it happens mostly in the medial compartment. So there's, I guess the best way to describe it is some people have kind of like bow-legged walking styles, you know, when they're kind of curved to the side. And you can tell when you see it. I think it's either varus or valgus. I always get the two mixed up. They sound so similar. But this kind of like bow-legged style compresses the medial side of their knee joint. And then those loads over time, like years and years of walking, can just kind of lead to these pathologies that kind of eat away at the cartilage. And then there are other factors like genetics. You can have a genetic predisposition. Diabetes can lead to it and some other things like that. But the idea of like super intense specified loading on the medial compartment is something I'm kind of more interested in, because you see that while we're walking. So when prosthesis users kind of lean all their weight to their intact side, we think they're overloading their intact lib, specifically that medial compartment, which is why we see such high rates in that population.
What is it about the knee that seems to be always problematic with like older people? And it seems, I don't know if this is recency bias, but I've got so many friends now blowing out their ACL, or like I've been dealing with a IT band issue. Why is the knee so vulnerable, or is that just not the right way to think about it? Yeah. I'm clinging on.
Yeah. It's really funny because I feel this way too. Once I started studying knee osteoarthritis, I was like, my knees hurt more than they used to. I'm like, I started playing like touch rugby here, and I would run, and then the next day I would be like, oh my God, my knees are so sore. I have knee osteoarthritis. What am I going to do? I think it's, I guess this is just my opinion, not based on, I guess, literature or some sort of informed, educated guess, but the knee is, I would say, more vulnerable just because so much of our energy dissipation when we're moving, like you have such a large degree of range of motion in your knee compared to things like your ankle, you have like 10 degrees of dorsiflexion, 20 degrees of plantar flexion, or maybe 50, somewhere between there, and like you can dissipate it a bit in like running techniques with like forefoot striking, so like loading your Achilles tendon more than your knee joint if you're doing some sort of rear foot striking. But during walking, no one's going to be really walking on like the balls of their feet. So I think a lot of that, especially if you're like taking a step down and you just kind of land on your heel, there's just going to be a lot of force that's mostly dissipated at the knee joint. And so I think that's just why we see more, when it comes to like cumulative loading over years, more focused about the knee.
Yeah, it seems like quite a complex structure as well. Lots going on ligament-wise.
Yeah, definitely.
So for people with prosthetics that do end up with osteoarthritis, what kind of treatment options are there for them?
In terms of treatment, I haven't looked too much into kind of... I'm focused more on the preventative measures. Once they get osteoarthritis, I mean, the real issue and why I'm so interested in kind of reducing these rates is because they already face such significant obstacles when it comes to staying active and healthy. And then once you kind of start adopting a more sedentary life, that's when it all snowballs, right? And then you get different diseases, diabetes, all these different things. And so osteoarthritis is just, if they have osteoarthritis and they have their prosthesis and it's like one limb hurts because they have knee osteoarthritis, the other limb hurts just from like the socket discomfort, then they're never going to want to kind of move, and then difficulty kind of staying active, being with their family, things like that. I think once you have knee OA, I think people get like cortisol injections, things like that. But it's really just to kind of reduce the pain. There isn't, I mean, eventually I think they'll do a total knee replacement, but that brings up a whole different load of issues and things like that.
And how, like, I'm just curious, because you're talking about, like, I guess, like, the different, like, loads on the knee and all these different things, and you're sort of, before you started your PhD, was in, like, in engineering in this sort of area. How have you applying that knowledge that you gained in that space into what you're doing now? And I guess, how do you make your measurements? Like, what are you actually measuring in your study?
So when I think about my engineering degree, there's definitely a lot of stuff I don't use ever. I've completely forgotten. I did a double major in electrical engineering. If you ask me how to build a circuit or fix a light in your house, I can't help you. I have no idea. But in terms of the actual useful practical skills, I mean, all those like joint moments, joint arms, is just, I guess, the physiological aspect of like statics and dynamics that every kind of engineer takes in our base training. So all those things are pretty intuitive to me, and it just allows me, I think, when I'm reading the literature, when I'm trying to understand these things, to kind of have a deeper understanding, or at least a quicker understanding when I'm going through them. And then also, at least in the US, our methodology behind how we train our engineers is very much teach you how to gather skills and learn new skills. So it's more teaching you a way to learn than teaching you like all these things you should memorize for the rest of your life. So I think during my PhD, and our lab is generally pretty good on this, we're all about kind of skill acquisition things. So we've started a coding club to try to learn different data analysis, data processing techniques in Python. None of us had ever used Python before, and we just kind of started doing it, followed along with these like free online lectures. And so now we have a bunch of our data processing codes in Python. So for like processing metabolic outputs, in terms of what I look at in the lab, I do 3D motion capture. So I actually work down at Neuroscience Research Australia, where dreams come true. and they have a cool Vicon 3D motion capture set up there. And so I work in their gait lab and their treadmill lab. And we put, it's actually really cool. I've taught so many classes on it now at this point. I'm thinking about it. I've explained the 3D motion capture a lot. I should be like a spokesperson.
well, you never know after all this.
Yeah, maybe. Given
Vicon
my best
sales
pitch.
Rep.
Yeah, Vicon Nexus.
Big 3D modeling.
Yeah.
This episode is sponsored by.
When do we get that?
But tell us, like the listeners would be super keen to know what 3D motion analysis is.
Yeah, so I guess the way I always started off, if no one has like ever been a part of these data collections before, is, you know, the Avatar movies with like the blue people. You guys ever seen like the behind the scenes footage where they put all like the markers and stuff on them, like on their face? Yeah. So the company, and this, it might be a different company, but it's the same technology. The company that makes those like cameras to kind of bring the actors into the movie and like portray them as blue people and like track their movements.
Navi, thank you very much.
Sorry. Yeah, sorry. My apologies, of course. Is the same people who make the equipment we use in the lab. So we place these little, like, they're called retroreflective markers, but they're the same kind of reflective tape you see on runners and cyclists that reflect the light from headlights. So they're super bright, super clear. We have that tape on these little markers, then we place them on kind of like anatomical landmarks on the body. So that can be around the knee joint, the ankle joint, on the feet, shoulders, trunk, everything. So we can like fully map a person's movement and motion. So the cameras in our room will like shoot infrared light that reflects off those markers, goes back to the camera, And then our computer maps that. And so we see this little person that's walking around modeled by all these little dots. And it looks super cool. It's the coolest thing I do, I think, is I get to watch people move, but I just see like the key elements. They're like knees bending, their thighs moving, jumping up and down. I've taught some classes where they do different like sports and activities, cartwheels, taekwondo kicks, shooting a soccer ball. So it's really cool stuff. Definitely my favorite part of my research, I think.
And what data, what information does the 3D motion capture give you from your participants?
Yeah, so it gives us, I guess, base coordinates for where the person is. So I go in, I label what each marker represents, whether it's like right shoulder, left lateral malleolus, so the outside of the left ankle joint. And I map those, and then I get these coordinates, so XYZ coordinates from each of these. And after doing that, I can just map their whole body, and then I have things like knee angles, and then we also have force plates in the ground that'll give us their ground reaction forces, so I then can also calculate knee moments and things like that. So ultimately what I'll do is take my motion capture data, take those ground reaction forces that I picked up in the lab from the force plates, bring them into this musculoskeletal modeling software, and then I can take their external forces generated while they're walking, and then I can also, in a certain sense, simulate what their muscles are doing at a muscular level and see what the cumulative load is at their knee joint. So that's like the big picture pathway of how I process my data.
And is that a very new technique? Because I remember one of the papers you gave us, which was looking at different angle moments or like forces put on the knee. And there were certain ones that correlated to osteoarthritis. But that was quite a while ago. I think like 20 years ago or something that paper came out.
Yeah, I know which paper you're talking about.
Is the field sort of now being revolutionized by these new technologies that can enhance either the data capture or the analysis?
Yeah, I think so, because the technology, especially around motion capture, is becoming more and more advanced. I mean, right now it's kind of going through revolution with AI, as everything is. They're doing like motionless or markerless motion capture. Mm. So cool. We don't even have to place those markers. You can like record it with an iPad. But yeah, what they used to do is they could still track your motion. It would take a bit longer, just computer processing power issues. But they could track your motion with a 3D motion capture and the force plates, calculate those external forces, but they didn't have the technology for musculoskeletal modeling, which tells you kind of what's going on at the muscular level or gives you some insight. So they would use this kind of proxy variable to say, this is what the loading is, what loading is happening at the knee joint. Whereas now you really should be doing musculoskeletal modeling on top of that, because if you just look at the external forces, that's going to give you a partial picture. But if you want to know fully what's going on, you also need how much like the muscles are compressing the joint as well. So it's kind of this multifaceted kind of loading experience we're looking at.
And when you do this in healthy and then people with prosthesis, what kind of results do you get? Like, is there greater forces that people are putting on the force plates when they have a prosthesis on?
Yeah, so far looking at my data, there's definitely this asymmetry that happens in terms of ground reaction forces in prosthesis users. Even when they're like trying to remedy it, it just kind of appears. So I collect them walking on a treadmill just normally, as they would. It's kind of a boring data collection for them. They just stare at a white wall in front of them, walk on a treadmill for 5 minutes and do that a bunch of times. But then the last trial, I give them this screen to look at that shows them kind of their weight distribution in real time. And even when they can see it, and I tell them, try to like balance these curves as much as you can, there's still just a natural inclination to shift to that side. And maybe with some more training, that could be remedied. And I know that's the focus of most prosthetists, is they really want to restore this kind of idea of symmetry, because I mean, in everyday healthy individuals, we see a very clear kind of symmetry while we're walking. And so it's kind of the gold standard. But to be honest, I'm not sure if that's the case, because they have such a natural asymmetry when it comes to kind of the mechanics of their lower body.
Is there something to be said for like the design of the prosthetics? Like, is there, you know, could there, this is not intended to sound insensitive, but like shock absorbing or like, I don't know, something designed within it or even what it's made of that could actually sort of make balance that out, that weight distribution out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's the other kind of lens and perspective when you look at this kind of research is, instead of what can the individual do to kind of improve their load distribution and their knee joint loads, what improvements can be made to the device itself? So there's a lot of research into the push-off power you get from a prosthesis, because you're obviously not getting that kind of power output from your gastrocnemius, your soleus, those plantar flexor muscles in your calves, because they're not there. So they've looked at making powered devices that kind of just give you a certain torque output at a certain time, or just really flexible, elastic prostheses. When I was at Vanderbilt, the project we were working on was actually adding kind of a elastic toe joint, because most prostheses don't have a toe joint on them. It's just a rigid carbon fiber plate. And so we looked at adding this kind of flexible toe joint, because maybe that improves stability on that side. Maybe it'll give them some power output when they're pushing forward, because you get kind of that elastic recoil. I'm not looking at that here. I kind of decided while I was in Australia, take a more physiological perspective. I really wanted to get better in my anatomy, my physiology. Part of the reason I guess I'm in the School of Health Sciences and not engineering, because I kind of want to have that sort of balance, because I think it's cool to have an idea of what's going on in terms of the mechanics, the engineering behind the devices, but also what's going on the human level. But yeah, definitely taking into account how the device is designed, because everyone is different. You can look at running blades, you can look at everyday walking blades. They have such different features.
I like one of the things I think you mentioned earlier a little bit about why is there that imbalance that people, probably not just prosthetic people, but people with injuries, why is there a balance in the weight distribution? Do you think it's these social, these kind of, you know, I've got a bit of a sore leg, I'm going to put more on this. What's going on there? Like, what are the factors that maybe people, end up with imbalance walking or strange gaits?
In prosthesis users?
In both, I guess, in injuries as well.
Yeah. In prosthesis users, I think it's, my personal theory is a combination of kind of just the discomfort around kind of the socket and that residual tissue. And then also you just have that lack of force production. In other pathologies and kind of in everyday life, I mean, pain and discomfort is a huge part of that. My advisor is starting a new project, kind of looking at pain and how that, when does that start to impact the way we walk, which is super cool. I'm not excited to be a participant in it, but I think it's going to be super cool.
Are you going to be one of the ones?
I think I'm going to get shocked a bit.
So they're going to induce the pain.
Yeah, I don't know the details of it. I won't dive into too much. Yeah. I don't know if it's under tight lip, under wraps, but yeah, that'll be a fun one.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, there's so many factors. Pain, definitely. I don't know, trust, like, especially after, like, if you have a significant injury, when do you start trusting that limb again?
Totally.
Is something. I sprained my ankle pretty bad playing soccer in high school, and took me a long time walking, running to really feel like I could trust myself to really push off and that was stable. Stability is also a huge thing. Are we going to trip and fall? That's a huge motivating factor when it comes to how we walk, why we walk.
And how much, like, I don't know what the word is here, but like, I want to say like disordered or like sort of unbalanced, like walking, how long would you have to have that for? In order, I guess it's probably an unknown answer, but like for osteoarthritis, like, are we talking like decades? Are we talking like years? Like, how long would you have to be walking with, like, you know, these like bowed leg sort of things for that to happen? Because I guess you think of osteoarthritis as being like a disease found in like older people, typically like older women. I feel like whenever I think of it, it's more of like a bone density issue, calcium diet issue. Yeah. I think there's also like bone stress. Like if you didn't grow up doing sort of resistance training or whatever. So I guess, yeah, how do all those factors work in with as well with your walking? Like, how long would you need to have these things to for it to take hold?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think because there are so many different factors, as you said, that can impact it, it kind of varies for each individual. There have been studies that have found if you walk a certain way, if you walk with kind of this bow-legged technique, or if you walk where you're kind of overloading that medial compartment, it can happen. You can see progression when you image radiographically within 3 years. That's not to say you're going to go from absolutely no pain to in 3 years it's going to be like crippling. Oh my God, I don't want to walk on this leg anymore. But it can kind of creep up on you. But there are so many factors where it's not just going to happen. If especially if you have lived like a pretty healthy, active lifestyle, you haven't had significant history of knee injuries, like no diabetes, no kind of other pathologies that are affecting it. You could potentially go a very long time, but if you do have a proclivity, then maybe it'll kind of accelerate on you.
What about your study participants, the prosthetic users?
Mm-hmm.
How much of a challenge has it been to get participants in? What is the prevalence of prosthesis users in this area, really?
Yeah, it is not high. It is definitely not high. That is, I would say, the biggest challenge of my PhD so far has been getting volunteers, just because it's such a unique population. I mean, I'm looking for people who are missing their limb in one side below their knee, have used a prosthesis for 6 months, don't have any other significant kind of comorbidities or pathologies that impact the way they walk, and can also handle the rigors of these data collections, because we also collect metabolic data, which they wear the mask that makes them look like Bane. But it also means they have to fast and not have coffee leading up until then, which is not enjoyable. I've done my fair share of those collections, and you can definitely get cranky. I have definitely gotten cranky. It's not fun. But yeah, it's been tough. I mean, luckily, once I get the people in the lab, this population is so great because they're all usually so interested in the research going towards progressing the science, because they want to see these devices get better because it's so applicable to them in their everyday lives. And so once they're there, it's great. It's just kind of finding those connections to get them in. And also, I'm not paying them, so it's usually just from the goodness of their own heart. And so their time is, I mean, I'm so appreciative. I'll come in literally whenever, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., Christmas Eve, I don't care, I'll be there. if they want to do it, if that's when they have free time, I'm happy to do it. But it's definitely tough. But we're hoping to kind of find those connections, because both Kirsty and I are kind of new to Sydney. I think Kirsty came here a few years before me, just kind of build up those connections, so eventually we have those existing pipelines for research in the future, because it is such a important thing to research, I think.
What is that process kind of like? Are you, you know, on the street scouting people out, like a, you know, a model agency or something? Or is there like symposiums or like get-togethers and things like this where you're networking with, like...
Yeah, it's funny you said like a model agency, because there have been a few instances where I've like seen someone walking on the street and I'm like, oh my God, they fit my study. I have to go talk to them. I'm also like, if I was a person walking on the street and some researcher, supposedly a researcher, I'm doing air quotes, I know you can't see it, but supposedly a researcher came up and said, I need you for my study. I'm not going to pay you, but please do it. I would definitely not trust that person, I think. And I also don't think it's in line with our ethics, so I hold off on that. But yeah, I did a lot of kind of rounds to different prosthetist clinics. Some were great. Shout out Inovo Prosthetics, unbelievable people. Some of them not so great. I won't name names. And yeah, kind of just going around handing out flyers, emailing different prosthetists, see if they have any advice, things like that, posting around kind of campus. But it's definitely not been easy. But some clinics have been really, really great. Trying to make the best flyers I can, most eye-catching possible.
And are you still looking for study participants?
Yeah. So
I guess we could like chuck a shout out on here. Maybe we can leave out your like email or something like that. So
yeah, that
people
would be
can
amazing.
Find you, you know, on social media, I guess. We can probably use some hashtags to do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's great that you talk about that process, because often even us as researchers, when we're looking for literature, we're looking for the results, what's happened at the end. And even though we're in it, we can tend to neglect all of that sort of background slog that has to go into eventually maybe someday turn around into better prosthetic designs, right? Mm-hmm. So it's good to talk about that and remind people that there's a lot of that sort of stuff going on. Your work now, do you see it having an impact on the design of prostheses in the future?
I hope so. I guess that's the ultimate goal. We'll see. Yeah. I mean, it's like my dream, but like it feels so far in the future that I don't want to like knock on wood, jinx anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, it would be really cool. And I think with all the technology that's kind of being developed, especially in the area of musculoskeletal modeling, I think there's so many opportunities just for it to get better. I use a free open source software called OpenSim, and people just kind of make these models, upload it onto this kind of forum, and then you can download it, you can improve it, you can try to make a better one. As it just keeps iterating on itself, like who knows the possibilities? I mean, maybe you can start incorporating very kind of niche specific things like, I don't know, the material the prosthesis is made out of or the footwear the person is using to kind of improve these simulations. And then that also kind of reduces the load on needing to recruit participants to come in the lab and do these kind of strenuous activities and exercises while still making advancements in the field. So it would be really cool if kind of the progression of this work eventually led to kind of improvements in prostheses, where they think about things like the knee loads on the contralateral side.
I know you're at still quite early days in the PhD, and I can understand this could be a rude question, but what's next? You know, do you see yourself wanting to go into prosthesis industry design, like you know, for a company that might make these kind of prostheses and might need some help from academia?
Yeah, I've definitely thought about kind of what's next. I guess, how can you not? I know I don't want to stay in academia, just not for me. I don't know, the stress of trying to find grants and money all the time is too much.
That's strange, yeah.
Yeah, I would much rather just kind of go into industry and kind of work within that framework, that structure. And maybe it's prostheses, maybe it's some other assistive technologies, maybe it's exoskeletons. I did a little bit of work on that in my master's. Maybe it's footwear. I don't know. But I know it's some sort of assistive device, assistive technology, I think is kind of what I want to focus on, what I want to do. Yeah. Definitely.
Nice. And do you think in Australia, like what's the landscape of these kind of technologies here? I really know nothing about it. Is it, are we front runners? Are we leaders? Or?
It's definitely, I don't know if it's front runners or leaders, but it's definitely a presence here. You definitely have kind of regional hubs, and I would say Australia is generally the regional hub for like Australia, Southeast Asia. I know there are big kind of companies. I think Osser is somewhere in Europe, somewhere over there, that makes a lot of prostheses. America has some things as well. I think if I had to pick, I would probably pick Europe, just because I haven't lived there yet. Might as well try it, see what it's about.
Try all continents.
Yeah, Antarctica will be a tough few years. Who knows, maybe that'll be the last one when it's developed, if it's developed. But yeah, I don't know. Kind of open to the options. That's what part of the thing I kind of love about doing the PhD is, I mean, I don't think anything else would have brought me here, especially definitely not as easily, and definitely not for like such a perfect amount of time. Whereas like I feel like 3.5-4 years of PhD, I can really experience what it's like to live in Sydney, and then I have that flexibility to kind of see if I want to stay in Australia or if I want to kind of move on somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful country. And yeah. also our PhDs, like you say, we can get it out quick rather than America. It's like a 7-year master's plus PhD.
Yeah, because you got to do the coursework. I am so grateful I do not have to do coursework. Oh my goodness, I've had enough of that.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you've got big dreams and big plans ahead of you and such important work. So, it's really nice to hear about it. So, yeah, thanks for coming on and thanks for telling us about your research and look forward to seeing the developments in this space into the future.
Yeah, it should be good. Thanks for having me. It's been fun. Been a long time coming. After I heard Key, my fellow LRG.
So those of you that have been listening, Key we had on as part of John's research, locomotion research group. He did fatigue and running, yeah. Yeah, so yeah, thanks for coming on. And we look forward to seeing where this PhD takes you in the future.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks.